I next met with Dr. Serge Verstovsek, who presented the landmark Comfort One study of the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis at ASCO and then ASH, and was first author on the just-published New England Journal paper with these results. I asked Dr. Verstovsek to present several patients from his practice to help better understand the clinical implications of these data. And to begin, he described a patient who at initial diagnosis was observed off treatment.
So this is a 63-year-old man that was found by his general practitioner to have slightly enlarged spleen by palpation, and then the CBC was done. That was the annual exam. And he was found to have slight anemia. Because of these abnormalities, a referral was made to a hematologist who did a bone marrow, and the patient was found to have increased cellularity, many cells in the bone marrow, normal chromosomes, but also some fibrosis in the bone marrow. The BCR-ABL mutation excluded the chronic myeloid leukemia. The JAK2 mutation was tested, which is seen in about half of the patients with myelofibrosis. It was negative as well. And the overall impression was that the patient suffers from low-risk myelofibrosis. Here, the low risk means that the patient really has no indication to treat. You see, we have no therapy other than bone marrow transplant that would really cure the patients. So rule of thumb is usually to treat the patients that need to have something corrected that affects their quality of life. He had minimal anemia, not causing transfusion requirements. He had a minimally enlarged spleen, not causing any symptoms. So among the three major problems with myelofibrosis, big organs, poor quality of life, and anemia, he didn't suffer from any, and he was relatively younger, 63 is not that old. Observation is advised. Now, what happens with this disease is it does get worse over time. I mean, the average survival of these patients is 5 to 7 years. Some live shorter, some longer. Having a low-risk disease, you would say you may live 10 years, but the disease does get worse over time. And then the symptoms come to play, like in this particular patient. After years of having a relatively dormant disease, general constitutional symptoms happen, like bone aches and pains, weight loss, cachexia, abdominal pain from enlarging spleen. And this was noted by his hematologist. And as usual, first-line therapy, he was prescribed hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea is a chemotherapy by mouth. It can decrease the spleen. It can help the patients. It is usually not very powerful to eliminate those problems because it does affect the blood cell count, and anemia usually or thrombocytopenia prevents institution of high doses. This is exactly what happened with this patient. There was some improvement, and patient was on the hydroxyurea for some time, but eventually referral was made to our centers to see whether there is anything better that can be done. Remember, that is standard way of usually finding these patients out. Usually they present with some degree of anemia or some enlargement in the spleen in a community setting. They are usually then referred to local oncologist, hematologist, and after workup they are found to have myelofibrosis. This is typical presentation.
So at that point you saw him, is that right?
That's correct.
And how long ago was that?
This was about a year and a half ago.
Okay. So what happened when you saw him?
So the patient obviously had some control of the disease, but suffered still a lot. The spleen was still enlarged. He did not regain his lost weight. He did have abdominal pain and all these constitutional symptoms. He then joined the phase 1-2 study with one of the JAK2 inhibitors, which replaced his hydroxyurea. And as now we know, the benefits of the JAK2 inhibitors were evident in great majority of patients, and it was seen in these patients. His spleen markedly decreased to about 3 centimeters. He was able to bend and eat more. He gained about 10 pounds and didn't have any major problems with the blood cell count. Blood cell count stayed the same, about the same, and he is enjoying his life on stable dose of one of the JAK2 inhibitors.
Which one is he receiving?
He's actually receiving ruxolitinib.
Any issues in terms of myelosuppression or side effects with it?
Now, this patient had a very good reserve in terms of a blood cell count. He was not terribly anemic. There was no real issue with those adjustments for him. He was on a 20 milligrams twice a day, which is probably optimal dose for ruxolitinib. There was no major problem with that. One aspect here is worth mentioning again is this patient did not have a JAK2 mutation. And again, this is very hard sometimes to understand, but patients do not need to be tested for a presence of the JAK2 mutation to be treated with the JAK2 inhibitor. These inhibitors are not specific for the JAK2 mutation. They inhibit the JAK2 whether it's normal or abnormal. And we know that all the patients with myelofibrosis have a high activity of the JAK2 for one reason or the other. Therefore, they benefit everybody to the same extent.
So when do you think is the optimal time to introduce a JAK2 inhibitor? For example, if you could have, at the point that he got hydroxyurea, do you think if it could have been done, he would have been better off on a JAK2 inhibitor at that point?
Well, that's a very good question, and it has to be individualized. Hydrea is worth to try in patients, and it may benefit the patients to some extent. The quality of a response to the JAK2 inhibitor is markedly better than to Hydrea. And remember the results of a COMFORT 2 study, comparing the ruxolitinib to best available therapy, where most of the patients were exposed to Hydrea. There was no real benefit to a best available therapy. In fact, as we discussed, and it's now known, best available therapy was almost as bad as a placebo in a COMFORT 1 study. So one would be able to argue with the success that instead of trying hydroxyurea in patients that are symptomatic and or have a big spleen, the right way to treat these patients is to go straight to a JAK2 inhibitor.
Now, what kind of work does this man do, and was he able to continue working during these last few years?
By the time that he presented to me, remember he was 63 years old at the time that he was seen first time by a local GP. He was from Kansas, an office worker. By the time he saw me, he was already 3 years later, 66, he was retired. And there was no issue with him going back to work, but what the therapy did is he was able to enjoy his life again. Many of these patients really take an opportunity to enjoy life again when they gain weight and are able to walk more, and they go and do what they missed for years, from dancing to playing golf or traveling. I would tell you many of the patients with JAK inhibitors improve so much that they're enjoying traveling again. Most of the patients are in late 60s and 70s with myelofibrosis, where they are already retired, and they have that free time that they now can enjoy.
What about in this man, I don't know if you recall or not, but what were the things that he liked to do, and you know, kind of what did he end up returning to?
This particular person was actually relatively well off, and he went to travel with his wife. The most memorable thing was that he went on a cruise in Panama and Costa Rica, sent me some postcards. Things like that. I mean, there are stories to say where people really have a different perspective on life. You know, they have a sedentary life, they lose weight, they're at home, and now they can change their lifestyle around. And they take the opportunity. They all know that this is not going to last forever. I mean, we are not curing anybody. We are controlling signs and symptoms of the disease. People do live longer, and they want to utilize that time to the best they can. So people really enjoy it.
Now, this man, how long has he been on the ruxolitinib at this point?
About a year and a half.
And I don't know whether he's asked this of you. I don't know if there's even an answer, which is kind of what should he expect from the future?
That's very common. And of course, we kind of a joke and I tell him that I can't see the future. But everybody is aware that this is a drug that is not a magic pill. It does what it does. It is good for symptoms and the spleen. It provides benefit for a time period. Whether this will be on average 3 years or 2 years or 5 years, it is obviously different for different patients. The symptoms and signs will come back. We may try different options at that point in time. Some look toward the bone marrow transplant as an option. Even when they are 60s, that's an option if you are in good shape. And this drug does change the outlook of these patients when it comes to bone marrow transplant as an ultimate curative attempt. Some do look into that seriously when they feel so much better to get rid of the disease. So we open different possibilities to a patient as they get better with this drug.
You're talking, okay, it's not curable, but I mean, do we really know? Can you really say to a man, a patient like this, you know, it's very likely you're going to have progressive disease, you know, at some point in time in the next few years? Or do we not really know that? I mean, are there going to be people who are going to be able to be controlled indefinitely so they die of something else?
Well, the real answer is we don't really know. By the way things are going, we do have a discontinuation of the therapy at a slow pace over years. In some patients, the benefit of the therapy might be 10 years or more. I would hope so. The longest follow-up, as it is now, is about 5 years since the initial studies were done. And these patients do well. So it is about a good dose and excellent response and maintenance of the patients on the drug without any compromise of the dose that ultimately leads to their good response for a long period of time.
Again, sort of backtracking to this man, is there any thought, rationale, or even trials looking at treating asymptomatic patients?
So the question is now that we know that we can reverse the process in terms of organomegaly and symptoms and prevent progression, which I think is the most beneficial aspect of this therapy, so that the patients live longer because of lack of progression. The question is exactly like you are saying, if we institute this therapy in patients that do not have a signs of advanced disease as of yet, can we prevent them from getting from low-risk disease to advanced disease and make them really have a long-term benefit of the drug in excellent shape for years to come? These studies need to be done. I mean, we don't have a real evidence whether institution of the JAK2 inhibitor in patients that are early stage, asymptomatic, would be justifiable at the moment. Obviously, it makes sense, but I don't have real data to substantiate that.
I was kind of curious if you could comment on a couple aspects of the COMFORT 1 study that looked at ruxolitinib and how that relates to non-protocol therapy. I thought one was the issue of imaging, and you all did MRI of the spleen, which I assume was more of a research tool, but is there a role for imaging, or you just follow patients clinically? And the other thing that I thought was interesting is you had some kind of like a web-based, I think, way to evaluate patients' symptoms. Can you talk about that and how you follow these patients clinically? Do you just have them come to the clinic and ask them how they're doing, or do you use any more advanced technology?
For the purpose of the trials, we have used our MRI to assess the volume of the spleen and myelofibrosis symptom assessment form, which is a complicated name for a questionnaire that was devised with the help of Food and Drug Administration to specifically target problems that are seen in patients with myelofibrosis. And it was used in the COMFORT 1 study for possible approval of ruxolitinib and led to its approval. This questionnaire asked 10 questions every day. It was provided to patients in an electronic form, little gadget that they answered every day for 6 months to see about their symptoms. Neither the MRI nor the myelofibrosis symptom assessment form are tools that we advertise to be used in everyday practice. It will probably complicate the optimal delivery of the therapy by focusing on these tools too much. I'll tell you an example. The MRI was used to assess the volume, obviously much better than physical exam. But for the purpose of approval, the study was designed to see how many patients have a 35% volumetric reduction in the spleen. And it says 40-some percent. That doesn't tell you really how many patients have a benefit. If you look at the waterfalls of the results, every single patient except two had a very good response, had some response, let's put it that way, in the spleen shrinkage. So what does it mean if you have a 25% reduction versus 55% reduction in the spleen? These are clinically beneficial results one way or the other. 35% volumetric reduction was just administratively determined point for assessment of a success. So to tell the patients that half of the patients respond because half of the patients had a 35% volumetric reduction is misleading. 20% volumetric reduction is clinically beneficial as well. So I don't want to emphasize too much utility of the MRI or a questionnaire for everyday use. People assess the spleen by physical exam, which is good guidance for adjustments of the dose, asking questions in everyday practice how they feel, and they usually actually tell the doctors how they feel without being asked because they feel much better. I think it's good enough for assessment of utility of the drug when you see patients in your office.
I was looking at that questionnaire. One of the things that kind of struck me, I think you maybe mentioned it before, was the ability to bend down. Is that, you know, a thing that you see as a common problem that goes away?
Yes. So the questionnaire was looking at the spleen-specific problems inability to bend or pain under the left rib, also inability to eat, but there were constitutional problems in terms of sweating, itching, bone aches and pains, and others. It was a combination of things. The improvement was seen across the board, regardless of the spleen shrinkage or not, to different extent.
Let's talk about your 74-year-old woman.
So this is a 74-year-old lady who was well and healthy, and then on a routine physical exam and blood count was found to have high platelets and white cells with some abnormalities in types of white cells, particularly 3% blasts were seen. She was also anemic at the level of 8, having hemoglobin of 8. On physical exam, she was found to have a palpable spleen about 10 centimeters below left costal margin and complained of significant fatigue and ability to function and perform regular activities of daily living. She had some pruritus, but no other major problems. She was seen by a local hematologist who confirmed myelofibrosis. Now, this lady has advanced features. Here you have anemia of significance. Less than 10 hemoglobin is considered very significant. She actually received some blood. She had blasts in blood, which are adverse prognostic factor, and she was older. These are all features of advanced case with a short life expectancy. More importantly, she suffered very badly from the symptoms. She was not able to function normally. And she was sent to us after a little workup for anemia. Usually you would like to see whether there is any bleeding in the GI tract, and erythropoietin was normal, iron studies were normal. So she was then referred to us for opinion on therapy because it's a combination of problems here. You have bad quality of life, you have anemia, and you have a big spleen. So all the clinically important factors are present in these patients. How do you treat?
Could I ask, what's the pathophysiology of the pruritus?
Pruritus is not very well known exactly what causes that. One would think that it is because of these inflammatory cytokines as a part of that process. Also, too many cells, particularly platelets, compromising circulation in the small blood vessels with the release of histamines from mast cells in the skin cause possibly pruritus. There is a lot of speculation on that part. But many patients with myelofibrosis, in fact, do have pruritus. They live with it. They don't report it as much as patients, for example, with polycythemia vera, where this is one of the major problems. Pruritus is, to our surprise, a common problem and significant problem in patients with myelofibrosis as well.
Anything symptomatically, other than making the disease better, but symptomatically that works with a pruritus?
With pruritus, otherwise, one would use perhaps antihistamines.
Do they work?
Rarely. It can improve, but not eliminate the problem.
So you saw the lady at that point. What were you thinking? How long ago was that you saw her?
This was about 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So what happened?
Well, this is the challenge here. See, we did not have too many options for these patients outside the clinical studies because use of hydroxyurea would perhaps improve the high white cell count and platelets and spleen, but would cause the anemia. That would be very likely. The medications that are in pipeline are of two sorts at the moment. One is what we have talked a lot, JAK2 inhibitors. They don't really have potential to improve the blood cell count. The anemia in particular, they do decrease the high white cells and platelets, improve the symptoms and the spleen. Other aspect of the clinical drug development is agents that specifically target the patients with anemia. One agent in pipeline that is being tested in a randomized study is pomalidomide, which in phase 1-2 studies previously was shown to improve the anemia. So one had the choices here, but looking at these particular patients, what we chose to do is to aim toward improvement of quality of life rather than the number, rather than aiming at the improvement of anemia per se. We wanted her to enjoy her life again, perhaps have a smaller spleen, and then utilize the transfusions if necessary occasionally. So she also engaged in a study with a JAK2 inhibitor. This was a different one than ruxolitinib. What happened is that the spleen did shrink from 10 to about 5 centimeters. Her pruritus and fatigue significantly improved. Actually, pruritus went away. Her fatigue improved. She gained about 10 pounds. She does get the blood transfusions about one every 4 months. And in terms of her willing to accept these transfusions, she always says yes, because her quality of life improves so much that she can enjoy her family again and play with the grandkids. She is coming to see me occasionally every 3 months on the study. And we are happy that we were able to achieve a compromise between benefits and risk in this particular case.
So which JAK2 inhibitor did she get and how did she tolerate it?
She went on the AstraZeneca JAK2 inhibitor, and there were no major problems with this drug at the dose level that she was enrolled. This was a phase 1 study. She's still taking without any problems. Actually, she's battling the weight gain. This is one of the most problematic issue of a long-term use of JAK2 inhibitors in general. People get much better, they gain weight, and some of the patients gain too much.
But that's just overeating, or is there fluid retention?
No fluid retention. It's overeating. It is also part of the reduction of the spleen, so you have more room. It is anti-inflammatory. You feel better. You eat more. And perhaps also mechanistically, there is evidence that leptin, which is important for lipid metabolism, is increased on the JAK2 inhibitors. And we know that the cholesterol and lipids in general go up on the therapy, as albumin does.
You mentioned pomalidomide. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about that in myelofibrosis and the other IMIDs?
Pomalidomide is another IMID immunomodulatory inhibitory drug that is coming along as a possible therapy for some of the hematological malignancies. It is derivative of thalidomide that has a different toxicity profile, which is particularly important because it does not have this aspect of neuropathy that is associated with thalidomide, and it does not have this aspect of myelosuppression that is associated with lenalidomide, the two other IMIDs. What was noted in the studies in myelofibrosis so far, and there are about 3 papers published so far, that at very low dose, maximum tolerated dose being 3.5 milligrams, and the effective dose in studies so far was 0.5 milligrams, at very low dose, it has a potential to improve the red blood cell count. For some reason or the other, we don't really understand the mechanism, in up to a third or perhaps 40% of the patients for a very long period of time. It does not do anything else in terms of spleen shrinkage or improvement of any other aspects of the disease, bone marrow or so on. It just really is focused on improvement of red blood cell count, and it's being tested in randomized studies, placebo randomized studies, to see about its true value for patients with myelofibrosis that are anemic.
Do you see a sort of a future of this strategy in view of the JAK2 inhibitors, or do you see any thought about combining it?
Absolutely. If the pomalidomide is really of a value, which has to be seen from this phase 3 placebo randomized study, one would definitely like to combine pomalidomide with JAK2 inhibitors for a dual effect, both on the spleen and symptoms and pomalidomide affecting the red blood cell count and improving the anemia.
I've been still trying to figure out how the IMIDs work in myeloma, et cetera. Any thoughts about how it might be working in myofibrosis?
Well, previous studies with lenalidomide were looking at the cytokine profiling of these patients, whether we are affecting TNF or VEGF, because it was thought to be perhaps also anti-inflammatory or anti-angiogenic. Studies with thalidomide attempted the same. The initial thought was that it was anti-angiogenic agent, but none of these studies, correlative studies, really pinpointed how these medications work. So this is still an unanswered question.
So let's finish out by talking about your 55-year-old woman.
So this was about a 55-year-old lady from Oklahoma that was worked up for a high white cell count, about 89,000, I think, white cell count with about 3% blast. Somewhat lower platelets, about 120, and anemia of 9 or so. And the bone marrow was done. The sample was not very good. They had a lot of fibrosis. The sample for molecular testing was not obtained and sent because of a poor sampling, and patient was told to have a myelofibrosis. On physical exam, she did not have any big spleen. Generally, she felt well, and she came to me to be evaluated for myelofibrosis and suggest therapy. So that was about 3 months ago. So some unusual findings were already there. There was no organomegaly. There was no general constitutional symptoms. We did a full workup, did the bone marrow, and the patient was found to have a BCR-ABL CML with fibrosis.
And looking back, was she treated in a rural area? Was she treated by or evaluated by an experienced oncologist? How do you sort of, you know, put this case together in terms of why it was misdiagnosed?
Usually that is because of inexperience, mostly in rural areas. If this is the case that was evaluated in the academic centers or large hospitals, probably they would do better work.
Was this something about in terms of how they did the bone marrow, or I'm trying to...
Yes, I think it's a sampling issue. And instead of repeating all the testing, people go online. You know, the patient was also not old, it was about in 50s. Many patients go online and search about their disease on their own. And they ask the doctors to be referred for consultation. They want to have a second opinion, especially when there is a question like this. Can it be this or can it be that? My test results are not good enough. The sampling was not good. What do I do? Shall we repeat it or let me see somebody else? And it's not usually only decision on part of the physician. It's usually these days a combination of things, and patients do have a lot of input what happens, of course.
So just to close out here, getting back to myelofibrosis, any myths or misconceptions out there in the community and practicing oncologists that you've encountered that you might want to address?
Well, the one misconception that we just talked about, it that fibrosis doesn't mean myelofibrosis as a disease. We do have quite a few patients that have a degree of fibrosis and they're automatically labeled as myelofibrosis. That's something we don't know much about it. Go and see somebody else. We don't have a therapist for it. Fibrosis can be seen in many different conditions, like this one, chronic myeloid leukemia. It is very common, as you know, in hairy cell leukemia, which is a totally different disease. I had cases where metastatic breast cancer was seen in bone marrow. Young lady, 45-year-old lady, with abnormal blood cell count, fibrotic bone marrow comes to me and we found metastatic breast cancer there. It is seen in ET and PV. Patients with ET and PV, essential thrombocythemia and polycythemia vera, that have some fibrosis, that doesn't mean automatically they have myelofibrosis. It is something that is seen in these earlier stages of MPN as well. There are criteria that one will need to fulfill to diagnose patients with myelofibrosis. Fibrosis on its own is just one of many factors.
So one final question is more by way of background. I'm trying to get a better feel for the different JAK2 inhibitors that are being developed. I got the one thing in terms of some of them also inhibit FLT. Any reason to think that the ones that inhibit FLT might be more effective? Or, you know, do you think this is going to be sort of a Me Too type thing over the next few years? Where do you think it's heading?
For a FLT3 inhibitors, and there are three of them that have been tested so far, the fact that they do inhibit FLT3 may not actually work in their favor, because all three so far have a DLT based on a GI toxicity. And the nausea, vomiting, and the diarrhea, although at very low grade, has a potential to compromise improvements in the quality of life. And that was seen most notably in a recent report of pacritinib at ASH, where about 70% of the patients stopped the therapy after 10 months on average. So it has the potential to compromise the delivery of a drug on a long-term basis.
Any indications of any advantages to these drugs?
FLT3 inhibitors were potentially, before we had these clinical results, an advantage actually over others, because FLT3 has a role in maturation of megakaryocytes. And in laboratory setting, the FLT3 inhibition actually does improve the activity of the megakaryocytes or decrease their activity in a dish. So there was a lot of enthusiasm that FLT3 inhibitor on top of the JAK2 inhibitor might be better and provide not just clinical benefit, but also improve the bone marrow. Unfortunately, we had this side effect that prevent their utility over a longer period of time. The JAK1/2 inhibitors appear to be at advantage by the fact that they, in addition to JAK2, inhibit JAK1, bringing anti-inflammatory aspects to their benefit.